Welcome, everybody. And just checking, we have Steve Smith on the call?
I'm right here.
Excellent, excellent. So I was going to give a quick background on how we were hoping to proceed, and then I was going to turn it over to Steve. And again, forgive me. Do we have roll call on the call? Just quickly say say here when you're here. We have Sumer. I guess people are probably
yes, I'm here.
Know Sumer. Okay,
I'm
Winfried.
Here.
Morgana. Celine.
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Celine. Tracy.
Here.
Hi, Tracy. Jonathan.
Hi.
Here.
I heard Mary. I heard Chris. Aaron Stupple.
Present.
Ambivalent, according to the chat. Candy. Okay. And just to be clear, do we have Morgana? All right. So all but Winfred, Morgana, and Candy. Good. So the goal for tonight's talk was to use each other's collective wisdom to help each other along with our projects. And I want to commend everybody who has done an excellent job of logging on to the Google documents and uploading or typing in information on their project updates and also some questions that they have for the group. As we proceed, I know we usually do this the Spark Start meeting screen that Becky usually sort of hosts. But I think that unless anybody feels strongly otherwise, we should switch to the Google document and use the Google document as a chalkboard for these discussions. Is everybody okay with that? Say nay or forever hold your peace. Okay,
yeah.
So we're switching to the Google document now. And what we're hoping is that while everybody presents, you take about a minute or two to catch us up on your project, bearing in mind that we all have a rough idea of what you've been doing previously, and then go ahead and try to bounce any questions or concerns you have off of us. And then while you're talking, we encourage fellows to maybe grab a color in the Google document. I have grabbed green. Or just type your name in brackets and then start putting in comments. And so we can try to use that as a chalkboard. We'll see how it goes. If it gets too crowded, we can refine that. Steve has volunteered to lead the conversation, and I'm going to sort of be the scribe. Are there any questions before we get started? So I figure we'll proceed in the order that the fellows appear on the sheet, starting with the mayor.
Nope, Anthony. Sorry.
Sorry.
That's not the way we're going to do it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, because I have, I want to make sure everybody follows this, this protocol that we have, which is a very fast 1 minute overview of your project, and then asking the group, some challenges that you're facing and getting some good interaction with the rest of the group. So I've already prepped my two mentees, Jonathan and Aaron. So I'm going to go out of order to start with and ask them to do it, and they're going to set the standard. They're going to show you exactly how we're going to do this, okay? So let's start with Jonathan. You can scroll down toward the end of the Google document. He's done a nice job doing that. So, Jonathan, do your thing. 1 minute to give a quick overview. Present some challenges, and then everybody jump in. Go, you're on.
Sounds good. Thank you, everyone. So my project is to help create a process to systematically identify and address the needs of our highest utilizing patients, the so-called super utilizer population, using a multidisciplinary team. And our current timeline is to have this process in place by June 1st. What we hope to do is help streamline the discharge process and then create a weekly one-time clinic that incorporates a multidisciplinary team of a community health worker, myself and another co-resident and attending, and then basically everyone else that is essential for care, so a pharmacist, a behavioralist, a nurse care manager, as well as a medical assistant. And we presented to some of the site directors at our community health center last week, and we got some good feedback and some good next steps to go from them. We've made some progress. So far, we have one attending who's willing to donate part of his faculty time to assist us in the clinic. We have the start of a database to look. We have, like, a historical database, so we know everyone that came to our hospital for the past 3 years. And then I'm now on a daily email, so I get everyone that's currently in the hospital. And so now I have to sort of figure out how those to make those two things talk to each other. So it just sort of tells me, oh, this person with this admission now has, say, four in the past year, which is our current definition of superutilization. Some of the big challenges that we face are that superutilization is very temporary. Among that group of patients that, say, has four or more admissions in 1 year, the next year they'll have zero. 40% of them will have zero without us doing anything. And so that's, you know, how we sort of, it's just regression to the mean in some of our cases. So our big things going forward that we want to formulate and I could use some help with is, does anyone have an example of a great discharge process in their own hospital? How do we really strengthen the PCP patient relationship with this? We don't want to, like, assume the role of their care permanently, but really be a sort of a stabilizing force potentially and then augment that relationship with the PCP. And then central to this, we think, is the development of a good care management plan. A couple of our payers now are doing that. And so if anyone has good examples of those, that'd be great.
Perfect. Great job, Jonathan. So people jump in, either both writing and on the phone. Anybody want to give Jonathan some feedback?
John, it's Sumer. I don't know if you read my project description, but it has a lot of relationships with what you were trying to do. For the last 8 months, I have basically devoted my professional career to this exact problem. I think so. There's two ways to tackle this type of problem, right? So what most people have first of all, I don't know if you read the Health Affairs article, I think it was a November 2013 article on the done by a group in Denver about the whole super utilizer population issue and how people move in and out of the population. And, you know, sort of similar to the data that you described. Are you familiar with that one?
Right. That's where we got the thesis that, or the hypothesis that the super utilization is temporary. And then we looked at our own data and it mirrors that exactly.
Right. So I think the super utilizer population that I work with in Vegas is similar in that, right? So people either stopping super utilizer because of the acute issue that caused them to become super utilizer is resolved, or they work in a high-risk clinic that basically allows them to, they become better, basically, because of the intensive care, and then they stop being used super utilizers because of that. But I'm skeptical of the data in the sense that I find it hard to believe that just because a lot of these patients have stopped being super utilizers, that they are no longer at risk for ending up back in that super utilizer pool if they drop out of a sort of ambulatory ICU-type setting or if, you know, some other stress causes them to be back in the hospital. So, yes, by the second year, most of them may very well be out of the high-risk pool, but there's always a significant chance that they'll get back in to that pool if you follow them longitudinally. And we've certainly seen that with our population here, both anecdotally some of the data.
Sumer, I'm going to have to jump in here. We're running out of time. Those are great recommendations and comments. Well, I've got about 1 minute. Anybody else have anything they want to add in a less than 1 minute to help John out with his questions? Oh, okay, we got some good comments written down there as well. Okay, I'm going to take my next mentee, Aaron, and ask him to do an equally distinct job as John did. Aaron, you're on.
Hey, folks. So my project is I'm peddling it out of the woodwork, and the idea is that good stewardship, there's lots of great resources, but they are scattered in different books and websites and blogs and podcasts, and they also have a legitimacy issue in that they're often kind of homegrown, they don't have the industry feel and sleekness, and they're also hard to get and hard to use clinically. And so what I'm aiming to do with my project is unify these disparate resources into something more centralized, with the idea that if it could be centralized, people could have more comfort with it. And the people I'm thinking of in particular are emerging clinicians, so residents and recently graduated residents. So what I've settled on as a plan, as this idea has evolved, is to use Tandem, which has been co-created by NPA and Consumer Reports. And it's basically, it's a web and smartphone application that focuses on good stewardship, and it's designed for use at the bedside. And so what I'm hoping to do is have a pilot where I recruit emerging clinicians to create content for Tandem itself. And the idea is that by creating the content, people will become familiar with it and would start to use it and have faith in it, and also grow a community that has some kind of cultural cover, that this is a legitimate tool. So the challenge that I'm having is that this is quite a lot of work. I created a module for type 2 diabetes, and oh, my Lord. So how do I incentivize people to take on the amount of work, especially as residents or emerging docs, and how do I actually create some sort of community out of those people? How do I get them in touch with each other and recognize that they are, doing something different, and they're kind of unifying this good stewardship field?
Great. So that's a great question, Aaron, put to all of you. What would entice you to put the work in to develop a module for Tandem?
It's Chris Petrilli. Are there clear, like, steps that you've developed then when you created your type 2 diabetes model that other people can easily follow to develop their own models, or is it more of an ad hoc process since there's only been one developed at this point?
There's a
template. Because I feel like if you gave people a roadmap, it'd be a lot easier to get people on board than if they have to kind of recreate the wheel every time. But I don't know what the process is, so that's why I'm asking.
That's a good point. There's a template. And I was thinking of possibly breaking down a topic for people and say, you know, as a group, a person could do section A, B, C, and D, and at the same time reach out to some content expert, maybe in one of the aforementioned pockets, and kind of bring in some person who's been doing some work outside, and then you have kind of like five residents or so do the chunks of the module.
Because my friend from when I was a medical student started this website called Wiki Journal Club, and basically people log in and they basically summarize all of the major landmark journals across everything. So it's wikijournalclub.org. They're not paid to do it, but for some reason everyone just logs in and either summarizes a part of an article and then eventually gets all built in. I'm not sure how he got that kind of support, but I think once you start a handful of people that get on board and word of mouth spreads, and then eventually maybe if you tell us about it, we could spread it through our individual programs and then have basically you get exponential growth that way. I think everyone who's interested in it would be willing to help out. So I think you just need the initial inertia to get through a couple of people helping, and then it'll just start spreading, which I think is what happened with my friend's Wiki Journal Club site.
Oh, my God, that is an awesome site.
Yeah, no, this is the best site ever.
Aaron.
Okay. Go ahead. Who's speaking now?
I just had a quick question. How is this different from, like, other models? Like, Hopkins have models on different, like, diabetes, hypertension, social determinants of health, to teach it in sort of an evidence-based way. Is that replacing that? Is it similar to that, or...?
I can show you. It's designed to be. There's a patient facing element of the app, and then a clinician facing, and it's got lots of, you know, do this, don't do that. It has a different kind of focus than
other content module. It's a totally different style.
Great. Okay, I'm giving everybody sort of an extra minute because we only have 7 instead of 10 of you, but we've got to keep it going. Thanks so much, Aaron. That was great. Now I'm going to go to the list in order that it is. So Samir's next up. Samir, you're on.
Awesome. My project, you know, like as we all know, over the last since the 90s, the hospitalist movement has really taken root, and it's very rare to see primary care physicians taking care of their own patients in the hospital. And that, while it has its benefits because you essentially create specialists who are really good at doing inpatient care, that's, you know, made up for by the fact that the people often taking care of the patients are not the ones who know them best. So the question is, where does that balance lie, and is that good for patients or not good for patients? So, you know, and in our superutilizer population in Vegas, our patients are sick and end up in the hospital pretty often. And what we find is that a lot of unnecessary and repetitive stuff ends up happening to them while they were there. So, you know, the question that we were asking is, does it make sense for us as primary care physicians to carve out time to be in the hospital, to be able to not directly be responsible for the care, but co-manage it in a way that is accepted by the admitting physician or the admission the physician of record, and at the same time be beneficial to both parties? So that's kind of like the basic gist of why we decided it was important to be there. And the project basically involves myself and my medical director doing some of the visits. Coach. Our visits consist of talking to the patient, getting a sense of why they think they're there, whether the patient understands why they're in the hospital, making sure they understand the tests that are being done to them, communicating with the relevant hospitalists and specialists that are taking care of the patient, talking to the case manager, and then basically the idea being that we prevent unnecessary testing, encourage things that should be done that aren't being done, and that with an eye towards everybody communicating, improving patient safety, and then also, you know, the big kahuna being ensuring safe transitions of care when the patient is done with the acute care setting and needs to transition out of the hospital, usually back to the primary care setting, but, you know, sometimes to a long-term care facility, et cetera. So
what are your biggest challenges here?
Yeah, so the challenges for us are, one is, you know, thinking about what do you measure to define success in this program. It's been kind of tough because a lot of the data is qualitative, so the question is it enough for my project to just set up the infrastructure for this? Two, is it a sustainable project? Because, you know, my being a fellow, I have time carved out to be able to go to the hospital, whereas a lot of the other clinics that don't have a fellow may not be able to do that. And three, the financial viability or having a doctor taken away from seeing patients in the clinic to spend a couple of hours a day in the hospital. So those are some of the challenges that I'm dealing with.
Great. Responses. I see some people typing. How about some oral responses?
Samir, it's Anthony here. I have a question. So this strikes me as like a very good idea in the abstract. I guess the question is, do you have any strategies for measuring it?
Yeah, so that's the question, you know, and we've been concentrating on things like patient satisfaction and as a more concrete measure, for example, whether or not a patient follows up within 7 days of being discharged to the clinic, which is one of our key performance indicators. And then a third thing we're working on is using pieces of the care transitions measure, which is a validated tool that allows us to measure whether patients feel like they understood their discharge instructions, whether they understand the meds they're taking. So those are some of the measures we're using, but the question remains is, like, are there better ones that get more at the crux of whether or not what we're doing actually matters, both in terms of cost effectiveness and safety, which I'm not sure what that's going to be.
This is Steve. I just want to say, I think if you come up with some good measures, this would be extremely valuable. I know CMS is planning a a pilot study very similar to what you're doing, paying primary care physicians for one visit in the hospital and seeing how that benefits the care. But I don't know if they've developed any outcome measures to look at the effectiveness of that.
You know, a few things I've seen. This is Aaron.
Sorry, before the hospitalist movement started, didn't someone like run some of these numbers already to sell the idea of this not being a good model? And then, so what is? And I understand people are unhappy with that. So there's got to be some data that you can use to kind of twist in your favor that'll show that this is probably a better model, because no one seems to be happy. Patients aren't happy that their doctor doesn't know who they are when they're in the hospital. PCPs are unhappy. They don't hear any information about what happened to their patients when they were in the hospital, and the hospitalists have no idea what's really happening with their patients. So no one seems to win the new situation. So there has to be a way that you – but somehow the hospitalists sold it that this was a great idea in 1997 or whenever it started. So however you could fix this would be great.
Thank you.
This is Aaron. I just want to say real quick that the amount of patient satisfaction that I've seen when the PCP shows up, it's like Jesus Christ himself walking the door. It's like a few times it's happened, people just say they are so, so, so happy.
Yep.
So I think
100% correct. Like they absolutely love it when their doctor or anyone from the clinic shows up. They feel like they have been saved. That's exactly right.
Yeah, I think if you measured that, and I know it's fuzzy, but I think the numbers would really blow it out of the water. Like a patient satisfaction response that's almost unheard of with other stuff.
Right.
Okay, well, that's great, Samir. The only other thing I would add is you might want to look internationally because that's the hospitalist model is the one that's predominantly used. There might be some measures on that, like from the National Health Service in the UK. So you might want to take a look there. Okay, great. Celine, why don't you present next? Student High Value Care Committee. Celine, are you there?
Press star 6 to unmute your line if you're muted.
Did we lose Celine? Well, something might have happened. All right, we'll come back to Celine. How about you, Tracy? Can you take the next slot? Okay.
All right. So Mike initially had a couple projects, but the final two that I'm currently working on now briefly, one is a call to action on the importance of patient safety in the ambulatory setting. And as I briefly mentioned here, ARC just came out with a report, and it was a report sort of saying that we need to pay more attention now to the outpatient setting and call awareness and importance of initiating a patient safety moving in an ambulatory setting. The other thing that I wanted to do, and now I'm finally at Emory, just started this week, I'll be doing something in an ambulatory clinic with the residents, is that I'm going to initiate morbidity and mortality and improvement conference in the outpatient setting. And today I actually got an opportunity to work with my department head, and she said that would be something that they would be interested in. I started initially working with that at my old clinic, but in the last few weeks I was trying to correspond and talk with people, and I'm no longer in the system. Those have been some of the challenges, so I think I'm going to have to basically do the conference at my new place of employment instead of doing a webinar as I was initially planning to do at my old clinic.
Great. And so your challenges that you outlined will kind of how do you transform this to a new setting?
Right. So, and sort of starting over. But not so much. I mean, the paper itself I've already started writing, but working with the finding, identifying who I would need to work with at Emory now sort of, takes me another month, I think, to do that. But they're very receptive and very interested in me giving sort of a grand rounds on it. So that would be part two of the project. The other thing, the measurable part, I have to check and see what sort of patient safety reporting tool that they have there. I know at my old clinic we didn't have one, so I'm sure Emory has one. But I have to see what they have and how often is it used and what areas are tweaking there so that I can measure the response if I were to implement or improve on their patient safety reporting mechanism.
Any responses, questions? While people are thinking, how often do you think issues arise? Is it how common are
daily,
serious
actually.
And not so serious?
Daily. Yeah. And looking at some of the, they happen daily. They're pretty common just as in the inpatient setting. It's just usually people aren't aware that there that these are errors, but errors occur daily.
I think it's a common misconception that continues to exist where, you know, safety errors and sentinel events only occur in the inpatient setting. So I would just comment that I think it's awesome that you're trying to bring that same type of awareness to the outpatient setting where lots of things get missed and done improperly. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
I was at a presentation this year sometime about safety issues in the outpatient setting, and they had a pharmacist present. And the stories the pharmacist had, you know, put your hair on end. So it might be something that you could think about working with the pharmacist as well on this, and I'm sure they would have some great stories. I know a day hardly goes by I don't get a call from a pharmacist about something I screwed up.
Yeah. Right,
actually, it's a great idea. They have their own pharmacy there. You know, Georgia did not expand Medicaid, so we do have a place where the patients there go afterwards to get their medicine. So that would actually be a good idea.
Hi, this is Celine. I'm not going to mute myself so that I can't unmute myself. But I know that what we've launched a kind of an M&M conference at Sinai that looks at overutilization, and obviously it's an inpatient rather than an outpatient, but I think that there's probably a lot that could be said for that in terms of over-ordering tests, getting false positive results, that leading to a larger workup, and looking at the M&M in that looking at the kind of morbidity mortality concept within that overutilization lens has been really great for us. So I just put that out there. It may be very relevant to outpatient medicine.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is there any kind of software to flag a case?
No. We did not have one at my old clinic, but we did have a lot of cases whenever there was, like, a missed cancer or a breast cancer diagnosis, delayed treatment. Those things were flagged and were addressed. And so I was basically going to use some of those stories in my talk. But now that I'm at Emory, I have to find out their way of tracking it.
Yeah, it occurred to me that, Anthony here, on the inpatient setting, the nurses have like a patient safety portal that, you know, gets logged frequently anytime anything remotely patient safety related comes up. And it occurs to me that there's really no such equivalent in our outpatient setting. Does anybody have any similar or anybody have an example of an outpatient patient safety portal?
No, but that's what I thought would be a good project.
That says a lot.
Yeah. You got your work cut out for you there. Maybe wiki patient safety events, HIPAA-friendly.
No, I think it's really great. And I haven't seen much in the literature, so I think this is really a wide-open field for you, Tracy. Okay.
Sorry, Tracy, this is Johnson. Our clinic theoretically has Quantros, but it's not functional right now, but at least the senior management talks about one day using Quantros in the outpatient setting. So that might be an option.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tracy. Celine, so now that you figured out how to unmute yourself.
I kept pressing *6. I don't know. I think my phone's just a little wonky. All right. Hi, everybody. So the project that I've been working on is this student component of an already established high-value care committee and trying to get student-led projects up and off the ground that really pursue, you know, various interventions that are aimed at value using generally a QI approach. I've been doing this with one of my mentors. We launched this year, and it's been going really well so far. We had a pitch day, which is basically when the students got to pitch their ideas to some celebrity judges. It was very exciting in December, and that went well. And then we're now working on the implementation component of it. One project launched actually this morning. It went very well. We'll see how it goes in terms of actually getting data and seeing that it changes behavior. And then the other two we're still working on. They're a little bit more labor intensive. So the one that we did today was just looking on decreasing full weight testing. And then the other two projects are looking at decreasing proton pump inhibitors for patients coming out of the intensive care unit and decreasing daily labs on inpatients, especially those that are ready for discharge, and avoiding that daily lab kind of culture that should probably end if a patient's stable enough to leave. So, yeah.
Excellent. What kind of challenges do you think you face there?
That's what I was thinking about this. So far, it's gone pretty well. I mean, one, I guess, the challenge is just working with students that don't necessarily have a lot of clinical experience. But so far, they've been very humble and very eager to learn as much as they can. And, you know, we've been able to supplement that pretty well. And I guess then just the reality of trying to use people's time that are already very busy and overstretched, and obviously we're not paying anyone to do this, but so far and I guess then it comes down to how are we going to sustain this, but so far I feel like the enthusiasm is there to certainly get through another year and another round of projects. So yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So this is Mary. I was just curious. I have a question about the project.
Sure.
I think you had said these maybe were first-year medical students. Do they have, like, protected time for this, or is it just, like, joining another, like, a club, and it's just part of their free time? I was just curious how this actually
works. I mean, it's open to all medical students, but probably the majority, like, 60% of them are first-year medical students. We got recognition as a student group, so we did have that little bit of budget. We are working on trying to get it to be a non-credit course, so it would show up on their transcripts, but not necessarily, they don't get a grade for it, but to at least recognize that time, though. Oh, I guess that's a challenge. That's been a little bit challenging to deal with the administration, because there's concern that it kind of overlaps with other curricula already in place. This is largely just coming from medical student interest and enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's awesome. You could see them potentially being able to get research time or something like that.
Oh, yeah. No, we're really trying to mentor them so that they publish this. Yeah. But
right.
We're trying to just get through the projects at this point. Yeah.
Sweet, I just have a question, because I'm doing a similar type thing, but with medical residents.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the issues that I have is, like, when they're on an easy month, they spend a lot of time, and then I don't really hear from them for months, because once they're in inpatient rotation. So I'm assuming the medical students have a similar type thing, like with exams or something. How do you keep them kind of going, or the projects moving, when... like, they don't have
when it's busy.
Much capacity. Yeah.
So what I've done is with my group specifically is that we meet every week. And some weeks we only meet for 5 minutes, and some weeks we meet for an hour. And it's very much dependent on what their schedule is. But we always kind of try to keep that let's get one thing done by next Tuesday sort of mentality in mind, just to keep the project going so that it doesn't lose steam. And I think, you know, it kind of helps that at Sinai, being in New York, we're all in the same building. So, like, their library is pretty much in the same building as my office. So they can come down for 5 minutes and then run back up. But that's what I've found to be useful for the students. For residents, it's harder. But
what we do try to do is have one resident sort of peripherally involved with each of these projects just so that they have some of that clinical contact. And again, it's like sometimes the residents can come, sometimes they can't, but we'll try to look at the big picture with the resident up front and say like, well, it looks like you have an elective block in March, so we'll meet then. If you can make it for 5 minutes off the floors these other times, that's fine, but if you can't, I totally understand. But I think keeping that sort of weekly check-in has been really, really key for keeping these things on target.
Okay, great.
Good luck, Chris.
With that.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Okay, and now I'm going to mute.
Well, we want to hear from you too, though. Mary, ready to talk to us about the overuse of telemetry?
Yeah, for sure. I've been working on trying to address the overuse of telemetry in our hospital. And there's a lot of reasons behind it, but I think it leads to unnecessary cost, unnecessary workup for patients. And in our hospital, they're actually tethered to the monitor on the wall, so they actually can't even get up and walk around very easily. They end up going to the bathroom on themselves. It's monitors oftentimes. And they really have no reason to be on the monitoring. So we first kind of looked at the actual overuse, and it turns out our problem is a little bit more complex than a lot of hospitals because we have nursing overuse without an order in addition to physician over-ordering. So one of the most robust interventions has been to require an indication with an automatic expiration for the order, but if we've had trouble getting IT and physicians in charge of IT to be willing to implement that. But even if we were able to, the culture is really that nurses feel like patients are safer on this monitoring. And so it gets put on no matter what. So I've been working on kind of education and for physicians, and I've tried to align myself with nurses and recruited kind of a nursing champion. I've met with nursing executives to try to highlight the alarm fatigue issue. And I think the nursing aspect of things, I think, and trying to get cultural change is probably the biggest barrier I have. And being somewhat new here, trying to even, like, get to know the people who I need to know to be in my corner. So I met with the chief quality officer today at the hospital, and he gave me some tips on people to contact to try to align with. But, open to any ideas on just change management in general, culture management, getting the right people to align, to all agree that there needs to be a change.
One thing that came to my mind, Mary, which is a little radical, I guess, would be providing patients with information so that every patient that gets put on monitoring gets a little handout on, why are you on monitoring? What's the purpose of it? And at the same time, how long does this have to go on? When can it stop? What are the downsides to it? So that they can be an advocate for themselves as well.
That is an awesome idea. I really, really like that. I will definitely think about a way to implement that on a system level. I think that's awesome.
Oh, I love that, Steve. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think Consumer Reports may actually have a patient-oriented two-page flyer about this. I'd have to go look as part of the Choosing
that's
Wisely.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, right. They probably do. You're right, because it was one of the SHM. Yeah, I mean, when you think about aligning the stakeholders, I guess I was all thinking about the systems in the hospital that create the problem, but you can think about the people that are also being affected by the problem and how they might be able to help with the solution. That's a really good idea.
One of the things that we ran into when we implemented our tele issue, and we initially had nurses very upset about the self-discontinuing orders, and even when there was no order, whether it expired or there was just none, they were also putting the boxes on the patients themselves. And I feel like once we made them understand that it also can delay care. So there's some tele places where you have to travel with the patient, and if you don't have like a SWAT team or whatever you call it in your hospital, like the transport services that can travel with someone who has like an unstable heart rhythm or something along those lines, where the nurse doesn't actually have to go to these procedures, that was a huge selling point for our nurses, that they didn't have to travel with their patients that were on telemetry.
Yeah.
So we said, listen, if you just follow the order that's there, and when it discontinues, understand that it discontinued appropriately, then you don't have to travel with. I mean, so the travel part was actually a huge thing for them, because they really liked it. They really liked when the patient wanted to shower, not having to chase down the MD for an order, okay to shower while on telemetry, things along those lines. So there was a lot of.
Yeah, and I think the truth is, like, nurses are great patient advocates, and I think that that they don't want their patients to fall from being on telly or be delirious from being on telly. But I think there's a culture also here that they're just safer. So they actually feel like they're doing it for the patient. And I'm seeing some questions about how can it be placed. And there was some mention of boxes. So our telemetry is actually still really old school. There's a monitor that's visual in the room, and they're connected to this, like, TV computer type thing at the top, you know, at the top of the bedside. So all the nurses have to do is have the cords and just plug it up to the monitor that's already there, and those are not hard to come by. So that, I think, is one of the reasons it's even a bigger tether than it is for some other institutions.
And then, so there was that JAMA Internal Medicine, I'll be real quick, JAMA Internal Medicine article in 2014 about the self-discontinuing orders in Cerner. So that Christiana Health study, they had Cerner.
Oh.
So I just forwarded you my email I spoke with the Dr. Dressler from Christiana Health, and he sent me up with, like, all their screenshots. So we just built that into Epic and our VA CPRS platform. So now I'm pretty familiar with all three of those platforms, how to do it. So if anyone on this call wants to do it at their institution, I'd be more than happy to help you with that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Good discussion. Okay. Well, last but not least, Chris, stop it. You're going to stop it for us.
Yes, that's right. Last and definitely least. So the stop it is kind of an idea of eliminating inappropriate testing. We were focusing mostly on residents, and we have a couple of attendings on board. So it's basically just a campaign. And thanks to Anthony, we actually rallied around our new pro chapter as kind of our focal point for this Stop It campaign. So we're having our pro chapter basically own this Stop It campaign. And we identified about 7 or 8 potential targets. We had about 32 people sign up for the pro chapter saying they were interested, and about 60% of them said they were interested in being heavily involved. So we're setting up, we actually had a national pro chapter meeting that Anthony arranged maybe a week or two ago, and we had a couple of great ideas that came from that, including more regular meetings, so it's similar to what Celine does with her medical students. So we're going to have biweekly meetings with everyone that can make it, and then quarterly meetings, and then monthly meetings with, like, just the project leaders. So we're going to assign each resident who's interested to a project, meet with them every week, and then with a broader group, like, every month or so. Basically, whoever can come to a meeting can come to a meeting, but we figure that the more interactions that we have with the entire group, the more likely it'll be able to stick. And we couldn't do them any more frequently than every other week because just people's schedules are busy, but we didn't want to do the big meetings more than less frequently than monthly, because then people just have great ideas right after the meeting, and if they don't do anything with them, then it would be 3 months before the next quarterly meeting. So the first project we tackled is inappropriate thrombophilia. So we we sent our manuscript to Lenny Feldman at JHM. So he's reviewing that right now. We implemented our new telemetry order set both at the VA and the U. So we have our abstracts that we're going to present for that at SHN this year. And then just as a point of, I thought this was funny, I talked about it on the call earlier, I received my chief medical resident eval from the residents themselves, and one of my areas for improvement included he places too much emphasis on high-value/cost-effective care. Three independent people wrote that, and I just sighed. Basically my challenge, what I already talked with Celine about having just kind of getting people up, continuing to push their projects forward while they're busy, and she had a great suggestion of just more frequent meetings and then possibly maybe not having the residents that are going to be really busy as the team leaders. So we're taking those suggestions to heart, and hopefully things start moving forward with some of our other projects as well.
Great. Well, I see that kind of let the resident feedback roll off your back. Well, I think you ought to take it as a compliment, actually. If you're
I thought it was more funny than anything else, because it's everything I stand for, and they hated it. Three of them hated it. Three out of 160, so not too bad.
Glory in it. Glory in it.
Right.
Other comments? Go ahead.
Just curious what your it sounds like your challenges that you're having people.
So we have people that say they're interested, but then they like get really on board for a couple of weeks, and then they go on a busy service, and then they don't either come back, or when they come back, they're just not as responsive with emails, and whenever we have a meeting with deliverables, they either cancel the meeting and or they show up to the meeting with nothing accomplished since the previous meeting that we had because they got busy. So I think having just only residents that have like just a notably busy schedule and they're stressed about doing other projects, maybe for their research, for their fellowship or whatever, that they're having difficulty keeping up with this. Ever since we launched the Pro Chapter, though, we've had about 20 people that are new. So we're hoping that this new blood that seems very interested in the Pro Chapter movement will fix that problem. But we just haven't met yet with great frequency. But we're going to start.
Yeah, just a quick feedback, Chris. Anthony here. So I think that it's really important to have both residents and attendings on projects like this. And the reason is because your residents clear out after a year or two of working on their project and go other places. So having a continuity of some attendings is helpful.
Yeah. I agree.
Chris, have you put the concerns that you have back to your group? Has this been an issue for the group to grapple with as well?
So the group's actually relatively small. My co-chief and both of us are staying as hospitalists next year, so we're going to continue the movement as the faculty advisors for the Pro Chapter. And basically we've told the groups that we're a little bit frustrated that like things aren't moving as quickly as we had hoped. But then we definitely understand where they're coming from. So I definitely agree with Anthony's point that we need to get people either attending and or maybe even some, like, a nursing staff, just anyone else besides just residents that have a very unique schedule that doesn't really lend itself to consistent progress with these kinds of projects.
There's something a little different going on, something higher level going on with this that struck me, is that there's attrition. There's attrition from folks who are doing less. And it's fighting against a dominant culture. And I think part of the attrition that you're seeing is, you know, people are into it and then there's like a cognitive dissonance, especially when you get busy, or it's like it's just easier just to put in orders and it's just order the damn telly already. You know, and it's funny that you're getting some crafts for doing high value care. I mean, come on. It's high value care. So it's almost like this just bothers people. And it'd be interesting to try to put a finger on that. I mean, that's what everybody's doing. I know it's pretty general, but I have to see, like, that's, you know, the value of the pro chapter is like you're fighting. Like, this is the good fight that, you know, this is hard to show up for because you're fighting against the tide.
Yeah, no, I feel that every day. Right, you're exactly right.
Right. That's sort of what I was getting at, too, is that asking or getting the residents involved sort of a meta-analysis of the process itself. So it's not just what they're doing, it's what's happening to them. And, you know, they originally committed to this, yet something is happening, you know, that's making it difficult for them. They should have an opportunity to step back and say, okay, let's kind of analyze what's going on. You know, why are we feeling so beaten down? Why are we feeling frustrated? Maybe why are we stepping back? And let them help try to problem solve in that area, focusing on the process, not so much as on the outcomes, but what's actually happening with them. Because I think it's so important, you know, to keep the residents involved and not just say, oh, well, you know, it's tough. When they get to be attendings, it will be better. No, it's not going to be better. You know, so you really have to be, you know, thinking about those intrapersonal battles that are going on as well.
And I think most of the projects I've been working on are actually to do something in the electronic health record so that prevents providers from working on things. So for our thrombophilia workup, now you can't order factor V Leiden, MTHFR mutation, prothrombin 20210. You cannot order that as an inpatient. So we're trying to do, like, at least black and white topics where I'm doing everything in my power to prevent these people from actually. So the easy way is for them not to order because they'll have to keep typing and try to figure out how to order it, but they'll never be able to. So education can only take you so far, but if you just really, this is like the ultimate hard stop because it's no longer there in the order set. So that's where most of the initial targets are going to be, is low-hanging fruit, so we can show some obvious success where we go to 0% ordering because it's just not there.
Okay, I just want to make sure that we haven't missed Winfred, Morgana, or Candy. Did any of you join the call after we got started? I don't hear anything. Okay. Well, we're at 9:55. Is there any housekeeping to be done, Becky, Jean, Anthony, before we conclude?
Hi, this is Becky. A very interesting call tonight. I want to remind folks that we do have our next scheduled call is March the 16th. I believe Harry Cho will be our speaker that night. And we also have the private page where we've been collecting your resources. I've been wanted to make sure everybody still had the access password for that. It's Capello-2015-access, and that will get you into the section where we have recordings from and the slides from all of our speakers here. So if there's anything you missed or you want to go back for, this is where you can find it, as well as some of our other resources that we've developed for you. I'll be adding a link to this, the call sheet that we we're working from tonight, so you'll be able to get that right here under the February call, along with the links to the recording there. So mark your calendars for the March 16th for our next group call, and if you haven't already scheduled your February call, individual call with me, please send me an email so we can get that going too.
Great. Thanks, Becky. I want to thank all of you. I've been on lots of, you know, show-and-tell kinds of conference calls, and they're usually deadly. This was, I think, one of the most energetic and and so many people were involved, and the feedback was great. Thank you, Anthony, for being such a great scribe and getting everything written down there. You know, this is a document that everyone can keep. I hope you'll have some time to look over the comments that were written down and reflect on them. And thank you all for being so good about strictly adhering to the timetable. We're finishing exactly on time. Anything else, Anthony, for the general good?
No, thanks, Steve, for moderating. One thing to look out for, we'll be sending an email just to get people's reactions to this call format, but I share Steve's opinion. I'm really impressed with what everybody did. Thank you all for your work. Also, I'll be in touch with an idea that we're cooking up about how best to sort of showcase this work. So we'll be looking out for an email from us. Harry Cho is debating between March and April, and I think he's now leaning towards April, but we'll keep you in the loop on that. Celine, we're glad to have Mount Sinai represented on the panel. That's all for me. Back to Steve.
Great. Okay, well, good night, everyone. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Good night, Ray.
Have a good night, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone. Bye.
Bye.